to live righteously. Hey, it's me, Richie T, and it's time for another episode of The Cultural Hall. It is episode number 124. In the second and third block, we'll be visiting with Heather Young, who was adopted. We talk all about her experience there. I've got just a couple emails that I want to share with you before we get into this week's episode, but also encourage you to look back. Episode number 122. With Drew Manning that we posted over conference weekend. That's great. That's the Fit to Fat to Fit, a guy who was a personal trainer who was trying to connect with some of his clients, couldn't figure out a way to connect to get him to lose weight. So he decided that he would gain 76 pounds. So he went the journey from being fit to being fat and then being back to fit again. Great story. And we talk all about the word of wisdom and in that episode and about eating healthy and about being able to inspire yourself to do that. So that's really cool. That's episode number 122. We also did an episode about the ordained women and the foreordained women. And I'm starting to get a little flack about that because the foreordained women is a fairly small organization. There are other women's organizations out there that are fine, that take the stand of being okay with women not getting the priesthood. And I've been in touch with them and we'll have them in future episodes. But there are some people that will come at me and say, hey, that isn't a very fair episode, but I didn't want to just do one point of view and not the other, so I did get both sides as best as I could, and we'll do more about that subject, as I'm sure women in the priesthood is not a subject to be going away anytime soon. And then episode number 123, kind of a culmination of a lot of things. It is yet again another member of the band Neon Trees. This time it's Tyler Glenn, who is the lead singer of Neon Trees. He's a returned missionary. He is recently come out to the world, letting people know that he's gay. He did that in the Rolling Stone magazine, and then I had the chance to sit down with him and talk to him about how that would affect his Mormonism and where he comes in there. So check that out. If you haven't listened to it, it is one of the best episodes of The Cultural Hall, episode number 123 with Tyler Glenn. And then if you go to theculturalhall.com, there is a video of him singing Where Can I Turn for Peace that is equally as awesome. So you can check that out. Right now, though, let's share these emails. First of all, this one from Jim. He says, hey, your left and or right channel audio problem has cleared up. What was the issue? It went on for so long, I'm now insanely curious what the fix was. Well, Jim, here's the thing. I have no idea. I recognize that it is fixed now, and I don't have any sort of clue what it might be. It might be. You'll have to let me know if it's, if the problem is back again with next week's articles of news. But if it wasn't there, or if there was no problem with this last week's articles of news, that being the week of April 7th, then I have no idea. And it's just one of those things that I continue to maintain is on some people's computers and not on other people's, because it's not on mine. I don't hear the problem on my listening device or on my computer, so I can't figure out what that would be. But Jim, let me know. You keep in touch with me. You'll be my audio go-to guy. That's Jim. Then we got this email from Ryan. Ryan says, hey guys, I love the show. And he capitalizes show because some people will still call it a podcast. He says, ha 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 ha, I am almost a lifer. I listen to the show every week and I'm just trying to get caught up on old episodes. He says, I really love how you guys are kind of, quote, progressive. It makes guys like me feel, it makes guys like me that aren't the most churchy feel great about the church and being a Mormon. I'm mostly reaching out to you today because of a story that I had to share, and in talking with others, I've come to the conclusion it's just too good to keep to myself. So let me say this right now. Future episode of the Cultural Hall, this is Ryan. He says, let me start by saying, I'm in the process of recovering from an alcohol addiction and rediscovering my own testimony. I'm a 24-year-old divorced male. When I was 19, I got married in the LDS Temple, and after my divorce, I started drinking and fell away from the church. I had a rough couple of years, really rebelling against the church and just doing anything and everything that I wanted because I was so mad at the church. During these few years, I was reached out to by the church to do a promotional video for the church for the Addiction Recovery Program. Ironic, right? Basically, I saw it as a little extra money for myself. The project was filmed on my birthday about 2 years ago. Being the person I was and it being my birthday, I was actually drinking in between shooting locations for this project. And after it was done, I went home and proceeded to get drunk by myself for my birthday. Really terrible. I'm not proud of it, but it is what it is. He says it's actually the main video today on mormonchannel.org, and then he provides a link. Anyway, after that was filmed, I kept doing what I was doing. I met a wonderful girl that I'm actually engaged to now, and we started dating. She is amazing, and she saved me. During this time, I got a DUI, and I remember praying to God that I wanted to die. I didn't care. I was drunk in jail and friendless. All my friends were too drunk to come get me. I prayed that I was done with life because no one loved me and that all I wanted was love. I received a feeling of peace, and the next morning, the girl I had started dating was there bailing me out of jail, and the look in her eye, I just knew a Heavenly Father had sent her to me. I'm tearing up just typing this. Ha 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 ha. Anyway, fast forward to now, and I'm 1 year sober. I'm going to church and ARP meetings, and I am going back to church. I have a long way still to go, but I now have the testimony that I never did. And the irony of being in a video about addiction really just goes to show how much God knows about me. There are a lot more details, says Ryan. But like I say, if you wanted a guest with an interesting and great story, I might be a decent option. Thanks for all you do and making my work days better. Keep up the great show, Ryan. So, Ryan, yes, we'd love to have you here in the Cultural Hall, and that will be an upcoming episode here. Coming back, though, in the second and third block, we visit with Heather Young. She's written a book. It's all about adoption and foster homes and what that's like and being taken away from your own parents. You'll find out what that is. That's the second and third block of the Cultural Hall.
We invite you to claim your courage by shedding shameful thoughts, actions, and feelings that disrupt your ability to live authentically or feel connected to others by letting go of fear, blame, and your idea of perfection. The Healing Group, where women go for hope, growth, and healing. We're the home of the Sex Girls. Are you a mother feeling lost in a relationship and feeling stuck? Are you feeling overwhelmed by life? Schedule an appointment now. Can't make it to our office? No problem. Meet with a therapist individually or with a group in our virtual clinic right from the comfort of your own home. Visit thehealinggroup.com for more information.
It's time for the second block of the Cultural Hall. On the phone with me from Iowa, the entire state. She's calling me literally from the entire state of Iowa. Ms. Heather Young, thanks for joining me.
Thank you for letting me represent the fine state of Iowa.
As I'm thinking back in Cultural Hall history, I don't know that we've ever had anyone from Iowa on the show. So, yes, you truly are representing the entire state.
Oh, good. That really lowers the bar for me. I was thinking I'd have to suck in my gut or something, but now I can just relax.
No. Put on the sweatpants and let's sit on the couch. That's how this will
yeah.
go. For those who listen to, I want to say we shared it in last week's Articles of News, but maybe it was somewhere else. I shared an email that I got from Heather. Where she said, hey, you know what? This is a little bit about me. What do you think? And I said, yeah, sure. Let's get you on the show. And here is the little bit about her that we shared. So she sent this along. It says, so what do you call a girl who was a Jehovah's Witness, then a Catholic, then a Jewish, then an Evangelical Christian, and who knows how many other religions, all before she turned 7 years old? Can we get ready for a badumching? A foster kid. What do you call the same girl who found herself adopted into a hardcore, abusive Mormon family? A girl banking on the whole eternal families are forever business not being true? That's Heather Young. And you've written a book called Ezra and Hadassah, A Portrait of American Royalty. And we just want to talk about your life.
Yeah.
So
that's, yeah.
That's it in a nutshell. And then now we'll talk for the next 45 minutes.
Yeah, I wrote a book. I wrote a memoir about my brother and I and our experiences growing up in foster care and then being adopted into a pretty bad, actually not pretty bad, to a really bad situation.
Okay.
And how we managed to make it out and be okay.
I'm going to ask a really obvious question perhaps here at the beginning. Your name is not Ezra or Hadassah.
No. See, that's the beauty of being an adopted kid, is I was named Hadassah Clinton Contrella Wade as a baby by my mother, and my brother's name was Ezra. And but when you get adopted, your names change. And so when I was 7 years old, when we were adopted, and my new adoptive family gave me a list of possible names that they thought went well with our new last name. Uh-huh. And so I changed my name. I picked the name Heather. So that's how I became Heather.
From the very beginning, sort of kind of an interesting situation, because I don't know that I would have picked Richie as my name had I had the opportunity to be able to pick it.
Yeah, well, the funny thing is because I was only 7 and I probably was behind in school, my new adoptive mother wrote out this list of possible names in cursive, and I couldn't read cursive. So I just went down the list and picked a name that looked pretty. And I liked the way she looped the H on Heather. And I wasn't about to admit that I couldn't read it. I had no idea what name I picked till she said it aloud. And then I was like, good enough.
Yeah, that one will do.
Yeah, exactly. I have to say, my birth name had a lot more thought behind it than my current name did.
And the birth name again was what?
Hadassah Clinton Contrella Wade. And my brother and I were born to parents who had problems. My mother is a paranoid schizophrenic and has paranoid schizophrenia. And my father is developmentally delayed. And so they met at Goodwill, where they both worked, and fell in love and got married, and then had kids, because that's what you do.
Yeah, that's the plan. That's how you do
it. Yeah, and the problem was, of course, they could take care of themselves, sort of, but they couldn't really take care of children. And so we ended up in foster care when my mother had a breakdown and needed to be hospitalized, and my dad couldn't take care of us. He functions on the level like an 8-year-old. Mm-hmm. And so we were put in temporary foster care, which morphed into full-time foster care over the years. And we stayed there until I was 7 and my brother was 9. And then what happened was we got caught up in something called the Great Experiment, the Termination Project is the informal name of it. It was a federally funded program in the early 1970s that was a grant that was given to the state of Oregon to see if they could get kids off of the foster care rolls.
Okay.
And so we got caught up in this this grant experiment to see if they could fast-track kids into either adoption or going back to their parents. And since my parents were deemed unfit to be parents, even though they had never abused us, never neglected us, there was never any calls about us, it was just the fact that my parents were, you know, developmentally delayed, basically. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we got adopted out. My parents, all the years that we lived in foster care, my brother and I, we lived in the foster home during the week, and then we spent weekends at my parents' house. Kind of like how kids, you know, with parents that are divorced,
yeah,
you split your time.
Yeah.
We split our time between our biological parents and our foster home. And anyway, one Friday, my parents showed up to pick us up, and we were gone. We were adopted, and they didn't know.
And that was because of this fast-track program?
Right, which was deemed a great success for everyone, probably except for us, because we were fast-tracked into a family we had never met. I had no idea what was going on. Our stuff was packed up in brown paper bags, and we were put in the back of a car and said, you're going to meet your new family. And we got dumped off, and that was that.
There was no sort of introduction to the new family?
No.
You know, like
nope.
Like as probably brutal and cold as I imagine it would be, I almost kind of imagine like a pound in some respects, where it's like, you know, everyone's sort of at this place, and then all these prospective parents come by and go, "Ooh, I like those two. Can we?" You know.
No, they were the state was on a mission to find homes for kids, so they called up my adoptive parents and said, "Hey, we got a couple kids. Do you want them?" And they showed pictures to my parents. My adoptive parents said, sure, we'll take them.
Yeah, you bet.
Seen. Yeah, we had less vetting than you would, you know, for a dog at the pound, yeah. Yeah, so that's what happened. And the interesting thing is my parents, in the midst of their extreme disabilities, managed to get themselves a lawyer. And they fought all the way to the doors of the Supreme Court to try to get us back.
Mm-hmm.
Took 7 years. And because of our situation and others like it, the laws around children's advocacy in court and court representation were changed. This all happened back in the 70s. And, you know, I'm kind of proud that even as a little kid, and I didn't even know it, we were breaking ground and making the world a better place for future kids that would come down the pike.
So talk to me about kind of your earliest memory then.
My earliest memory is being at the foster home, because I lived at the foster home. By the time I was two, we were a full-time at the foster home. So I remember that was my first home.
Now, when you say foster home, there's a difference between a foster home and an orphanage, yeah?
Yes. Orphanage, you know, it's kind of like a warehousing. And in our foster home, there were anywhere from 6 to 9 children that kind of came and went. And they had the core kids that stayed, and then they always accepted emergency kids. Our foster home was actually pretty typical, I think, in that they were in it for the money. And so, you know, we weren't part of the family or anything. We were their paychecks. And we knew that. All the kids knew that.
So the foster home typically is a husband and wife, and maybe they have a couple of their own kids, but then they
right.
just kind of will take in any kids at any time, and it's a constant turnover.
Right, right. And my brother and I were one of the few kids that stuck around. We were a long-term placement, and we would have stayed probably in foster care in that situation a good long while if this termination project fund grant hadn't come along. So, but don't get me wrong, it's not like the foster home was great. My brother was physically abused there, and I was sexually abused by the foster family's biological children. So it wasn't a cakewalk there. And that's where we were introduced to every religion under the sun, because Sunday mornings was the only time that my foster mother got a break from us. She'd ship us off to whichever local church was willing to come pick us kids up and take us. So, you know, depending on whose missionary moment was at the time, that's where we went. So I'm not sure how many churches I actually got baptized into. But I have to say, hands down, the best program that I remember, I love the Jewish church. Their children's program, they had singing, they had really good snacks, their cookies were to die for. And, you know, Catholics, kind of boring, lots of sitting, you know, listening, well, you know.
And then a little standing, and then a little sitting again, and then some more standing, and then some sitting again.
Yeah, Jehovah's Witnesses, we were that because our biological parents were Jehovah's Witnesses. So when we were with them, we did all the Jehovah's Witness stuff, which is pretty time-consuming and a lot like being a Mormon.
Yeah.
So, you know, when I got adopted and became a Mormon, I was not particularly impressed. This primary thing was killing me. It was way too much singing. Sharing time was, like, unbelievably boring. And the whole thing took too freaking long. So, yeah, I was not used to the rigors of being a Mormon kid.
You're like, 3 hours? Come on. The Jehovah's Witness,
man.
We get this done in an hour. Let's go, people.
Well, that and I had to dress up for the Mormon God, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The other ones, I could wear just my regular street clothes and my very comfortable, you know, boots and stuff. And for the Mormon God, I had to wear a dress and dress shoes and the whole schmear. And it was a lot of work. And I recognized early on that this being a Mormon was a higher level of worship than I'd ever had to do before. And I was not particularly committed. My brother, on the other hand, he loved it. He thought being Mormon was awesome. And he really, for a little kid, he really connected with it. For me, not so much.
We'll get back to that real quick, but I want to go back to a couple of things that you've already touched on. Being in the foster family, and you said that there was some abuse that occurred, and I don't want to get necessarily too into this, but by the biological children of your foster parents, right?
Yeah, they had two sons, and they took advantage of me and the other foster girls.
First of all, I guess I would wonder, is that a common occurrence in foster situations? And then two, was it like, there was, like, the favorite children were the biological children, and then the other ones were just kind of a meal ticket, as you alluded to?
Because that would be natural and normal. Yeah, so they did stuff with their own biological kids that they didn't do with us, you know. And the biological kids were first position. It was kind of like, I don't know, like I imagine being in a polygamous family.
Mm-hmm.
You got your first family, and then you got the rest of everybody else. So, we were not the favored ones.
But the dynamic, I guess, for me is where I'm trying to understand, because you're fairly young, between 2 and 7 at that point, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, when you're saying that they're doing stuff with the other kids, was it like, all right, between 2 and 7-year-old kids, you stay home by yourself and we're going to go do this stuff? Or what do you mean?
No, it's just that their own children, the biological kids, you know, had more privileges,
mm-hmm.
had better furniture, you know, bedroom furniture. They just, you know, and their parents, of course, as you would expect, always believed whatever the biological kids said.
Okay.
So that's how the abuse was allowed to happen. Because, you know, there was no question that their children would never do such a thing.
Oh, no, not him.
So,
not
no,
him.
No, their boys were awesome. So, and as a foster child, you know early on that you are there at the whim of, you know, the foster family. Mm-hmm. And if the children, if I was ever dumb enough to come out and say, hey, your boys, you know, they got issues, I would have been out the door.
Right. So you don't,
Yeah. No, it's a game of survivor, man. Do what you got to do to get through it.
Are instances like that, do you know, and you don't have to speculate. In fact, I would prefer if you don't speculate, but if you knew, is that a common occurrence in foster homes?
I will speculate. I would probably say yes in homes that have older kids.
Okay.
Yeah. I think the dynamics in our foster home were not unusual. And I hate to say that, but yeah, you know.
So,
there are, of course, really admirable foster families who I totally adore and respect, but I can smell the ones who are in it for the cash from a mile away.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the motivations are, pretty, it doesn't take long to figure it out. And frankly, you know, it's a hard job. Being a foster parent it's really hardcore hard.
Yeah.
So you got two groups of people, the people that do it out of total dedication and love, and then you got the other group, which are people who are looking for a job.
So you finally get the word that you're going to be adopted, and I would think that is every foster kid's dream.
Yes, you would, of course, think so, and that's exactly what the social workers said who told us we were going to be adopted. But I had no clue what they were talking about when they were saying that we were going to go to our, you know, forever family and that we were so lucky. In the back of my mind, it was like, okay, we're going to go live with these people for a while, and then we'll go back to our parents.
Mm-hmm.
Because we never lost our bond to our biological parents. Keep in mind, our biological parents were good people.
Right.
They were,
still
like,
around.
Way better than the foster parents. You
yeah.
know, they were religious. They, like, went to church. They, like, really lived their religion. They were good people. The fact that my mother thought that she was from another planet and, you know, often visited her other realm, and that my dad was an 8-year-old, you know, they didn't yell at us, they didn't spank us, they didn't, you know, we had a good time with them.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, to be told that we were going to be moving and going to live with our new family, I didn't get it.
Mm-hmm.
I thought in my little mind that it was just a short time kind of thing, and that we would return to our real parents, because they were our parents.
So what was that like then? You said that they just came and picked you up, they packed up your stuff, and then it's boom, new family.
Yeah, they dropped us off on the doorstep and introduced us and then left. It was hard. It was really scary. I was terrified.
Now, were there other kids in that family, in your adoptive family?
Yeah, they had adopted previously 2 other children, and so there were 2 other kids that were close to our age there already. And it didn't take long for me to figure out that we had moved into a darker realm of hell. Any illusions that my brother had, hoping that he was going to escape the physical abuse he experienced in the foster home, was gone, because for him it was 12 times worse in our adoptive family. My brother is developmentally delayed, just like our father.
Mm-hmm.
So my brother, even though he was 2 years older than me, he functioned at a much lower level, and our adoptive family felt that he was fine. He was just lazy. That there was nothing wrong with him. He just he needed to learn how to work.
Sure.
And so they tried to starve and beat him into submission. They thought he was just a really stubborn kid who, you know, his will needed to be broken.
Literally starved and beat him?
Oh yeah, yeah. He after the first year that we lived there, he didn't ever eat dinner again until he was kicked out when he was 16. So, yeah, for a good long while, my brother, he He didn't get Christmas. He didn't get birthdays. He was locked in his room 24/7, other than going, you know, to school. It's pretty tragic what happened to him. I don't think that's unusual either, though, in abusive families. I think it's actually more common that there's one kid that takes the brunt of it. There's a scapegoat, you know. Mm-hmm. For all the family's problems, whenever anything goes wrong, it's that kid's fault. And so there's one kid who gets the worst of it, and it was my brother. And then when he turned 16 and my adoptive family got tired of dealing with him because he could not comply with what they wanted, they kicked him out. And actually, it was pretty funny. They shipped him back to our biological parents. They got him a bus ticket and sent him back to our biological parents, where he finished high school. He ended up living with our biological parents.
And were you like, hey, wait, I want this deal. I want that.
No, actually, by then I was pretty hardened off and probably in shell shock. And I was glad my brother was leaving because he needed to get out of our adoptive family's house. I said a prayer for him, and that was about it. I was different because I had figured out how to survive. And I had created a community of friends and people who watched out for me. So I had a lot more to lose. And I was scared at the thought of going back. I didn't want to go back to my biological parents because I remembered them and I had good memories. Mm-hmm. But the unknown, when you're in my kind of situation, when you're a foster kid or in any tenuous situation, security is what you want.
Yeah.
And so the unknown is much worse than the known. So I wasn't even given the choice, but I didn't do anything heroic. I didn't try to save my brother. I didn't try to make things better for him. I was busy trying to, you know, survive myself.
Now, as I understand it, this adoptive family, they're a Mormon adoptive family.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So everything was done in the name of God and, you know, eternal families and all that stuff. Yeah.
So that... I mean, that to me is kind of an interesting dynamic. So I hear about this abuse, you know, the starving and you alluded to physical abuse, yeah, but certainly emotional abuse.
Yeah.
I have a really hard time with that. I have a hard time with that in general because I think people should treat people well, and maybe I hold Mormon folk to a different standard, but. You kind of jokingly pass it along saying, oh, yeah, all done in the name of God. But how did that kind of stuff occur?
I think back in the late 70s and early 80s, I don't think the systems were in place within our faith or any other to really reach out and help kids that are being abused. I like to believe that things are different now.
Mm-hmm.
That maybe the laws and society has changed. But back then, you know, because we didn't have any obvious marks on us, and because everything could be excused away by saying, hey, these children were adopted from a bad situation.
Oh,
anytime
yeah.
anyone questioned my brother looking unusually thin or, you know, anything being not right, my parents just said, hey, you know, we're doing good work here with hard kids.
Mm-hmm.
This is not easy. And so everyone, of course, would bow and say, well, of course you're doing good things. I'm sorry for questioning.
Mm-hmm.
So that was that. So, yeah, and nobody, there was a whole bunch of none of my business going on. Like what everyone does in their own house is their own business. And as long as there's no obvious marks or anything, then the kids are okay. And over the years, of course, we had bishops and church leaders who knew stuff wasn't right. But what do you do about it? Because, again, as kids weren't saying anything. It's just like in the foster home, you know, every man for themselves. You figure it out, and you keep your mouth shut and keep your head down and pray nothing happens to you.
You know, and as I'm listening to this, I'm trying to not just be really upset sweeping it under a rug of, oh, these were different times, but this was not very long ago.
No, back in the early, you know, mid-80s and stuff. But even now, though, like, what do you do? If someone in your ward, your congregation, you suspect is treating their children badly, if there's no obvious evidence of it, you know, what do you do? I mean, my mom was Relief Society president.
Uh-huh.
My dad was in the bishopric.
Mm.
I mean, like, on all accounts, we were a good, outstanding family. You know, we were very active and involved, and you know, and why wouldn't they believe my parents? Keeping in mind that we are all adopted, and kids are quirky, and kids have issues, and again, back then there just wasn't the awareness, and there was no internet, so you couldn't like search anything. You just,
yeah, I don't know. You know, but a time with no internet, I'm having a hard time believing that.
You know, I'm sensing a lot of skepticism on your part. You just seem like you're not really an optimistic kind of guy.
A time with no internet,
you're very
though.
Doubting, you know?
You had me until a time where there was no internet. I'm not sure that I believe that ever occurred.
I think it was easier to isolate and be isolated back then.
Sure, absolutely.
And nowadays, if I was in that same situation, I would not be, because I would have been blabbing all over the internet. Mm-hmm. I would have had a blog and Facebook. I would have been like, I am living in hell. Yeah. Get me out of here.
So, yeah, livinginhell.blogspot.com.
Exactly,
Coming back in the third block of the Cultural Hall, I want to talk about, from that time, pick up where your brother moves out, and then I want to talk about how you remained being a member of the church, even with all that and all that stigma and everything like that. So that'll come back here in the third block of the Cultural Hall.
Running a small business today can be difficult enough. Imagine all the work you have to do to market it. Imagine the hours you put in to create promotional materials for it. Now, imagine a partner that can help you with all of that and more. Imagine Lennon Design. Lennon Design is your partner in business when you need a professional look at a price you can afford. Whether it's websites, advertising media, promotional materials, and more, Lennon Design can help you promote your business. When you need creative, affordable designs, let it be Lennon Design. Call 801-699-3022 or visit LennonDesign.com.
Sidewinder Media was named as one of Utah's top photographers by In This Week magazine and is a winner of several awards for fine art, portrait, and event photography. Sidewinder Media has been professionally photographing everything from wildlife to headshots for over 10 years. Sidewinder Media has the experience and the knowledge to capture your special occasion or portrait the way you want it. They also film and edit music or product videos and do simple ads for Facebook or websites. Email them at sidewindermedia@gmail.com or call Rusty at 801-941-5576 to book your shoot today.
All right, it's time for the third block of the Cultural Hall, visiting with Heather Young, author of the book Ezra and Hadassah, A Portrait of American Royalty. People can get that online, I assume, but
yes.
In bookstores as well?
No, just online. It's a self-published book.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I tried for a year to sell it, and I had lots of agents say, this is such a good book, but there's no market. No one wants to read memoirs from the 1970s. And I was like, I'm not that old.
That makes it sound like it's, you know, 200 years old.
Yeah, I was like, geez, Louise, you know? So, yeah, I finally, out of sheer frustration with the publishing industry, just thought, screw it. This is why God invented, you know, Amazon.
Yeah.
But I'm really proud of it.
Where we left off was your brother had moved out of the house. You didn't kind of really, you know, push for him. It was every man or every woman for himself or herself.
Right.
So at the time then, if I'm getting time right, he would have moved out when you were 16 or when you were 14. He was 16.
Right.
He got to go back and live with his your actual biological parents. So then that leaves you. Is this a different state that you're living in? He's gone away? Okay.
Yeah. Our adoptive parents, our family had moved to Arizona. They put him on a Greyhound back to Oregon. And he was with our biological parents till he graduated high school. And I finished growing up in Phoenix, Arizona.
Okay. So 14 is about eighth grade.
Right.
So then what was that like? Your brother's gone. You're wondering probably what's going on with him. Plus, you've got abuse in the home in which you live, and you're, you know, dealing with being just a regular teenager, which I think is hard enough in itself.
Yes. And, you nailed it exactly. It was pretty horrific. And, my brother, honestly, I wish I could say that I worried about him, but I didn't, because I knew that he was going to be okay. Just getting out of where we were was enough. I knew that our biological parents, Ralph and Claudia, were not going to abuse him.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know what else would happen to him, but I knew that he would get fed,
mm-hmm.
and that they would be nice to him because that's who they were. That's how I knew them. And so they were happy to have their son back. They, again, as devout Jehovah Witnesses, after they had lost their bid to try to get us back to the courts, they just kept a prayer in their heart, you know, saying Jehovah will provide. And they never moved. They stayed in a crappy house for 13 years, expectantly waiting for us to come back someday. And we did. Rex did. So they were happy to have their son back. And they also were paranoid that if the state found out that he was back with them, that he would be taken away again.
Sure.
And so it was all kept very quiet that he was there.
So what was your middle school and high school experience then like?
Pretty horrific because, you know, I was going through all the typical teenage changes of life in a bad situation. By then, my parents financially hit rock bottom, and we went from being solidly middle class, probably maybe upper middle class, to qualifying for food stamps.
Mm.
So things were not good at our adoptive family's home at all. And I had to get really resourceful and figure out how to meet my needs without bothering my parents with anything. So I had to steal what I needed. So I babysat. And when I was in junior high school, I was too young to get a real job. So, yeah, I did babysitting, and I stole from the people that I worked for.
You stole?
I stole soap. And when I hit that wonderful age of puberty where my period started, I stole whatever, you know, sanitary supplies I needed. And I just took care of myself, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's what you have to do.
Yeah, because in our adoptive family, they didn't provide soap or toothpaste or anything like that. You had to provide that yourself. They provided a roof over our heads and food,
mm-hmm.
but our clothes and everything else was up to us. We had to earn our way. And their thought was that we were old enough to work and we needed to. So we did.
What kind of role did the church and the gospel play in your adolescence?
It saved me. It was I am only okay today because I had excellent church leaders who did reach out to me, although they were not aware of what was happening
mm-hmm.
because I wasn't telling them. They were kind to me, and really, what saved me was my seminary teacher. I have to give props and a shout to my seminary teacher at Maryvale High School in Phoenix, Arizona. His name was Don Davis, Brother Davis. He's now lives in Utah, teaching somewhere. He's still a seminary teacher. He's still working. It blows my mind. But he's in Utah now, and it was because of my seminary teacher that I'm okay.
What was it about him?
He he was a good man, and he listened to me. And I told him more than anyone else. I was able to share with him some of the stuff that was going on at home. He didn't know it all. Nobody knew it all.
Mm-hmm.
But he became my moral centaur. I never, actually, when I graduated high school, he gave me an amazing gift at seminary graduation. He gave me a new set of leather-bound scriptures with my name on them.
Mm.
I'd never had that. And during the time that I was in seminary, the scriptures in the church had been changed or updated. Well, mine didn't get updated because my parents weren't going to pay for that.
Mm-hmm.
And so he gave me a new set of scriptures. And I still have them, and I still use them. And he gave them to me because during the 4 years of high school, I never missed seminary, which wasn't really hard to do because I lived in Phoenix. And seminary was a regular class. We had early release seminary, like all you people out west.
Mm-hmm.
We did not do early morning sacrificial seminary. I don't think I could have done that. But because seminary was a class in my day, I never missed it. Because I never missed school. Because I would go to school with a fever and throwing up rather than stay home.
Mm-hmm.
Staying home when you were sick was just ridiculous. Because all you did was you ended up working. Yeah, I did chores. There's no rest for the sick,
mm-hmm.
so it was better to be sick at school than not. And because I had perfect attendance through seminary, Brother Davis, we became buddies, and he helped me, and I could talk to him, and he listened to me, and I love him for that. And because of him, I'm sorry, I'm getting emotional. Because of him, I gained a testimony. I didn't want to gain a testimony. I wasn't in seminary because I loved the gospel. I was in seminary because I needed someone who cared. And Brother Davis was one of those people who cared. And I'm really grateful for that. The offshoot of it was during those years, I actually read the Book of Mormon, and I received a witness that for me, this was the true church for me, and the Book of Mormon was true for me. And I understand people who don't feel the same way or who read the Book of Mormon and didn't have a burning bosom in their testimony. Mm-hmm. For me, it was just a gift from God to reassure me that it was going to be okay. And well, I needed that.
Was there ever anything with you, because where your family, your adoptive family was Mormon, so it's the same belief that you are, you know, trying to find out if it's true and you're having these experiences with. Was it ever difficult to kind of meld these two different thoughts where you're like, so much pain, so much anguish, so much uncomfortability has come from people of the same faith, and then also for you to have these experiences with Brother Davis and be like, man, this is where I am finding my strength, finding my direction, finding kind of this purpose.
Yeah.
Was there ever some difficulty in associating those two together?
No, and I think the reason why is because I was 7 years old when I was adopted, and I did have experiences with other religions, and so when my adoptive family would say stuff that I didn't think sounded right, I had, you know, when they would say that God wanted me to get punished for whatever, there was a part of me that just kind of rolled my eyeballs and went, whatever. You know, I didn't believe them. I just didn't believe them. And so that kept me sane when I have to say that some of my other adoptive siblings were not as lucky. They suffered the same abuse I did and have not come out as well because they didn't have the benefit of being older when they were adopted. They got the full indoctrination from when they were very young, and I didn't have to go through that. I knew there was another God besides mm-hmm. the one that my adoptive family kept telling me about. And I really did resist for years. You know, they made it a family challenge and all that stuff to read the Book of Mormon repeatedly, and I never did it. Mm-hmm. I refused to. I faked it in family time, but I never read the Book of Mormon because they wanted me to read it, because they were insistent that I had to read it. And so I was like, hell no, I'm not doing it. And it wasn't until I hit seminary and Brother Davis gave me the challenge to read the stupid book that I finally was like, okay, fine, I'll read your dumb book. And, you know, then I found God.
Have you?
Dang it. I didn't expect that. I just wanted Brother Davis to like me. I read the Book of Mormon. I started reading it because it was something you checked off, you know, the list of things that good people do when you're a Mormon.
Mm-hmm.
I did not expect to receive any comfort from it.
Have you been in touch with Brother Davis in the years?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've talked to him on and off, and you know, in the book coming out and stuff, we've talked, and it's just really, I'm so happy he's still teaching, because he's got a gift. He's got a soul, and that's just wonderful. And the kids that have him are, even if they don't know it or appreciate it, they're lucky to have him.
So you graduate from high school?
Yes.
Then what happens? Is it, forget it,
well,
sayonara, I'm out of here.
I did. On my 18th birthday, I was sayonara, I'm out of here, and I moved in with a wonderful Mormon family who helped me heal, and I lived with them for a year and a half, and they were a blessing to me in every way possible. They taught me what a Mormon family should be like. And how things should go.
How should a Mormon family be like, and how should things go?
Well, they should probably feed all the kids.
Okay.
They probably shouldn't go around beating people. They probably shouldn't verbally and emotionally, you know, abuse them.
Mm-hmm.
And they probably should, like, show love. You know, I don't know. It's a wild concept. So, yeah, they were, like, nice, normal people, and they took me in off the streets. Thank God.
Was it?
They were a blessing.
Was it? It's not a family in the same ward where you were living.
No, it was in a neighboring state, which, it, of course, Arizona at that part, time and place was a lot like Utah, where, you know, a ward in the state was like 10 blocks long.
Mm-hmm.
So less than 3 or 4 or 5 miles from my adoptive family, I moved in with a family that was in a totally different state. And that was what I needed. I needed to stay in the area because I had a part-time job and I was going to school at the community college, and I needed to stay in the area, but I could not stay. I needed to get the hell away from my adoptive family, and I did, and it saved my life.
So how did you meet this family then?
I was friends with their son in high school. We went to the same high school, and he was in my seminary class. And, yeah, so when I needed a place to go, I actually had, like, 5 different families that offered to take me in. I had one of my school librarian who was Jewish. He and his family offered to take me in, and then I had my best friend from high school, she and her family were Catholics. They wanted me. Mm-hmm. And then I just had all these other religions, and I picked the Mormon family because I wanted to stay Mormon. And I knew that if I went with anyone else, although they were all good people, I knew myself well enough to know that I would fall away from the church. And I knew that that's where God wanted me. I prayed, and I had that confirmation, and I can't deny the feelings that I had that I needed to stay. So I did. I went with the Mormon family, but I could have easily gone with the Catholic or the Jewish or, you know, wherever.
Mm-hmm.
I was just lucky because I had options. My siblings did not have the same options that I did. And I was really, really lucky that I had a community of people that pulled me through, even though none of them really knew the full story. All of them just saw parts of it. I never told any of them the whole story. And I did that probably because I needed to survive. And that's, I'm sure there's lots of psychological reasons why I didn't ever tell anyone the whole story.
Mm-hmm.
Writing this book, for the first time, I told the whole story. And it's been interesting because Brother Davis and some of those other families and my friends that helped me through my life, they got to see the whole story for the first time. Reading the book, they never knew. So, and they didn't know how important they were to me and how much I really needed them. And how grateful I am for all of them.
When you talk about the time of your healing, you talk about some of the really base things like, oh, yeah, you were able to be fed and provided for and some of that stuff. What do you look to as like your healing in that time with that family?
I was able to, for the first time in my life, to relax, and that turned out to be a big deal. Until I moved there, I didn't recognize the level of anxiety that I live with and the fear that I had all the time in me. I was so used to living like a scared rabbit, I didn't realize that things could be different. And so I learned how to relax and to feel secure. And that was quite a trip. I didn't know that people had that. I didn't know that existed. And it was a gift. I needed that. I was really tired and worn out by the time I got to the Bingham's house. And I was really tired.
Mm-hmm.
And I was so lucky. I can't even tell you how lucky I was that I managed to land in a family that, for no money, they weren't paid to take me in.
Right.
I didn't have any money. My adoptive family sure wasn't paying them. They did it all on their own. They paid for me. They fed me. They bought me Christmas presents. They paid attention to my birthday.
Mm.
And when I met my husband and got engaged, they were there for me on my wedding day. And I'm really lucky that I kind of adopted myself into their family. And they made a huge difference. And I wish every kid that was having a hard time had friends and family and teachers like I had. And then, of course, for me, the end of the story is I married well.
Mm-hmm.
I married a really good guy who took me to the next level of healing. And that was a process. And I married a guy who was willing to do the work to help me. And, you know, we've now been married 27 years. We have 3 kids. You don't know the rest of the story. You got to read the book.
Yeah. Yeah.
Everyone has to read the book.
Okay.
I got reconnected to my brother. And
Wait, you're making huge leaps here. You're leaping years at a time. I want to know. Yeah. So you go live with the Binghams. When did you meet your husband and how?
Oh, I met him at a church dance.
Of course. Duh. Of course.
I was in Arizona. Arizona is just merely, you know, a suburb of Utah. So yeah, we met at a church dance. I had known his family because they had moved into our ward like a week or two before he left on his mission. Mm-hmm. And when he came back from his mission, and I heard about him all through his mission. It was really obnoxious because his parents, he's their only son, and they adored him. Mm-hmm. And they were obnoxious in that they would say, "Our son, you know, Robbie." And they were every time there was a sacrament meeting talking about missionary work, Rob's parents always got asked to talk, and they were always reading his letters home from his mission from the pulpit and fast and testimony meetings. They'd be like, "I want to read to you from Robbie's letter from the field," and oh, it was just annoying. So I felt like I knew of him before I met him. And then, yeah, like the week that he got home, his sisters drug him to a young adult dance, and they introduced us, and it's so stereotypical. It's funny, but it is interesting. He did admit to me that the only reason he was interested in me was because I was the only girl at the dance that was in a skirt. Everyone else was in jeans. And since he'd only been off his mission a week, he was still shell-shocked, and he couldn't handle the sexuality of girls in pants. Too much. So he was interested in me because I wore a skirt. And, of course, I was like, I only wore a skirt because I just got off work and I didn't have time to change.
Yeah.
So, like, there was nothing spiritual about it. But, hey, you know, God works in mysterious ways.
Yeah, take it for how it is.
Yeah.
And now you have three kids. And and now let's catch up. So now you're able to, you were able to be reunited with your brother.
Yes. And that's a story of serendipity. My brother grew up and he wandered and he was homeless and he struggled because, again, he functioned on the level of a third grader. He was an 8-year-old kid. He could barely read and write, couldn't really take care of himself. And so, as you would expect, he ended up homeless. Mm-hmm. And he ended up homeless in Salt Lake City. And he had some hard times. He had really, really hard times. And Salt Lake City is a wonderful place, but it's no fun if you can't afford to be there. And being a homeless person anywhere is no fun, but Salt Lake is interesting, I guess. And he ended up working. He got the homeless shelter, helped him get a job at DI, and he sorted shoes and stuff, mm-hmm. and he hated it, and he was miserable. And he decided that God wanted him to go to Washington, D.C., to correct the tax code, because he felt that if the tax code could be changed and made more equitable, then there would be no poor among us, mm-hmm. like him. So he set off and he hitchhiked. He was hitchhiking to Washington, D.C. when he had his spiritual experience, and he found God, and he found who he called his best friend. He found Jesus, and Jesus, his best friend, told him to go to Cheyenne, Wyoming. He was hitchhiking along I-80, mm-hmm. from Utah, and he got a ride from a trucker, and the trucker took him to Cheyenne, and God told him to stay in Cheyenne, and so he did. And that's where we met up. He was in Cheyenne, and I got a call from church headquarters telling me that my brother wanted to be in touch with me, and I'm like, why? Why is Salt Lake calling me to tell me my brother, who I hadn't heard of from in years because I lost touch with him? I didn't know where he was. He was in Cheyenne, Wyoming, and wanted to catch up with me. And at the time, my husband and I and our children all lived less than an hour away. We were in northern Colorado, and he was in southern Wyoming in Cheyenne. And so that was the beginning of our reconnection. Hmm. And my brother was a wonderful man, and Cheyenne really became his home. His best friend told him to go to Cheyenne because the people in Cheyenne needed him, and he needed to stay to help them, and so he did. And Cheyenne turned out to be the most loving and wonderful place for my brother. He found a home in Cheyenne, and he lived there for 5 years, and then he developed a brain tumor. Mm. And the last year of his life, he couldn't live alone, and so my family took him in, my husband and I, and he lived with us for the last year of his life, and he died in our home in my husband's arms. And after that, I reconnected with our biological parents because it turned out our biological parents, in their love for us, had taken out life insurance for us when we were young children, because that's what good parents do.
Mm-hmm.
And they provide for their kids. And so they were contacted by my brother, by the life insurance company, notifying my parents that my brother had died. They didn't know. I didn't even know where they were, my biological. We had lost touch. And the insurance company helped reconnect me back to my biological parents. And the insurance company gave them my contact information. And the phone rang one day, and there it was, my biological mother saying, "Hey, what happened to your brother? I understand he died."
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah. So within 6 weeks after being contacted by the insurance company, my biological parents showed up on my doorstep, and they never left. And we're here. And they are now, now my parents are elderly. They live in a nursing home about 2 miles from my house, and I take care of them.
Oh.
And my mother calls me every day to tell me what she's eating for lunch and what they need and what they want, and I take care of them. And they're my parents, and actually we're planning their 50th wedding anniversary.
Oh, my God.
Coming up here pretty quick. And, you know, it turns out my parents were right. Jehovah did provide. Jehovah had a plan. I didn't get it. It was a hard plan. I do not recommend the plan that we all had to live under, but Jehovah did provide, and it all worked out.
Heather, let me ask you 3 questions before I let you go. We ask everyone here in the Cultural Hall. Number one, do you have a calling in your ward right now? And if so, what is it?
I don't. I'm a visiting teacher.
Oh, that's a calling.
It is a calling. And I don't, only because of my current life situation, I honestly don't have time.
Sure.
And so, bless his heart, I did talk to the bishop when he tried to extend a call to me, and I just laughed, and I said, "Bishop, you don't understand what's happening in our house and in our life right now. Because we don't have callings, we are taking care of a lot of stuff in our house that you don't have to, because we're doing the heavy lifting. So really, Bishop, I'm helping you out by not having a calling, because if I had a calling, I'd be calling you saying, 'Help me.'"
Yeah, my calling is taking care of my things.
Yes, so you don't have to.
Yep.
And, you know, he appreciated that, so it's all good.
I appreciate the honesty as far as that goes. I think some people would try and do something like that, and then, as you say, you know, place a burden on someone else.
Yeah, we're taking care of my 2 elderly parents who are developmentally delayed, plus my mother-in-law who's got dementia, and we have special needs children and a grandchild with special needs. So our house is pretty stressful.
Yeah.
My husband and I are taking care of a lot of people who need help.
Well, and it's amazing. It's amazing for you to be doing that, be able to do that, and a great blessing to everyone involved to be able to be taken care of by family who loves them.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, we feel lucky.
If you could pick a calling for yourself, either one that exists or make one up, what would you pick?
Oh, hands down, nursery. Been there, done that. Love nursery. The best experience I ever had in nursery was the year that I only had 3 kids in the nursery, and 2 of them were inactive, and I never saw them. I had 1 child who showed up every week during his nap time.
Yeah.
My job was to feed him a snack, and then we would curl up in the recliner and sleep. It was awesome. That was when I knew Jesus knew me and loved me, because I needed a break, and I got it for 1.5 years. I took a nap every Sunday, and it was what Jesus wanted.
Uh-huh.
It was great. I highly recommend nursery.
I love that. That's awesome. Last question. What is your favorite part of your faith?
My favorite part is the comfort that I get. You know, the hymn, "Where Do I Turn for Peace?" That's real. You know, where do I go when there's nowhere else to turn? That's what I get. And I'm lucky to have it.
The author, Heather Young, of the book Ezra and Hadassah, A Portrait of American Royalty. You can find it online, I'm betting, by Google searching Ezra and Hadassah, A Portrait of American Royalty. But we'll also post a link in association with this episode at theculturalhall.com. Heather, we appreciate you coming in and sharing your story. And
thank you for having me. I really enjoyed this. Thank you.
We hope that this has nourished and strengthened your body, and that if you weren't healthy enough to listen this week, you'll be healthy enough to listen next week, and that you'll be able to drive home safely when the time comes. In the meantime, we'll be saving a seat for you on the back row of the Cultural Hall.
Save me a seat. It's sure to be neat on the back.